Hello, I'm Dan Masterson, host of Strategy Talk. With me today are Austin Bay and Jim Dunnigan. Austin is an author, columnist, blogger, and contributor to StrategyPage.com. Jim is a military analyst, consultant for the U.S. military, and well-known author. On Strategy Talk, we discuss current events with our own unique twist. We report news as history. Welcome, Austin and Jim. A couple of weeks ago, something happened that personally was very distressing for me, having, you know, friends and relatives in the Army and a brother that's a psychiatrist, with this psychiatrist going in and basically, you know, massacring all these members of the military. I know personally I went up and looked up all the names and what the, where they were from and what they'd done, and it was just a very disturbing incident. And as the news came out about the history of this guy, it was just unbelievable that he had been allowed to stay in the military as long as he had. And I guess the question is, with our military contacts and like that, my first question is there a mindset in the military right now that you cannot say anything that's anti-Muslim or bring up anything that may be seen as anti-Muslim?
Austin, you're closer to that than I am.
I wouldn't frame the question that way. I mean, you know, the thing is that it's something perceived on that. Really, a better way to frame it is, are there implications, social implications, that there are certain types of criticism of people's race, religion or the like, is that considered to be inappropriate? I'd say yes. I'd say that some of that flows from, this is going to strike some people as a bit odd, but it flows from that. You know, we're in one, we serve in one military organization with a lot of different people, a lot of different backgrounds, kidding and joking and harassment are just part. And I'm talking about jocular harassment are just part of the military life. But be considerate of others. But you see, the thing is that what Hassan is talking about, Dan, is not something that really deals with Islam. In my view, the man's a traitor. The man was talking treason, violent action against the United States. He was also speaking, and I'm talking about some of the things that I've read. I know you have as well. So is Jim, about he wasn't going to follow his orders and serve in Iraq and Afghanistan. He objected to it. Okay. He objects to it, then resign your commission, get out of the service or the like. Now, the thing is, I think it is completely appropriate for the military, but this shouldn't apply to the military. This applies to common sense Americans when someone is in the process of talking himself or herself into a violent action against the government. And you heard, you know, people know the difference between somebody lipping off and saying, "Oh man, I'd like to really, I'm so ticked off, I'm ready to really go out and do something, man. I'm so bad, I punch somebody out." Or like, people can tell the difference between that and someone who is moving towards, or in the process, as I said, of psychologically convincing himself to act violently against the United States or take violent acts against his fellow soldiers or fellow citizens. And there's always a component of, when people hear this, I think, gee, I don't want to overreact, could be just blown off steam, a component of free speech and recognition of that. At the same time, we've heard this happen before, and not simply since 9/11. I mean, we had reports after McVeigh launched his attack on the federal building in Oklahoma City of statements that he and some of his cohort had made about what they thought about the federal government. People have to pay attention. Is there a constitutional issue in there? Yes. Is there a a line that needs to be drawn? Yeah, somewhere. It may be a bit of a gray, hazy line, but you need to pay attention because the Constitution, the pop line is, the Constitution, not a suicide pact. No, somebody's taking violent action. You need to pay attention. We pay attention when somebody even whispers a threat against the president, and the Secret Service takes that very, very seriously. And why? Because they've seen cranks articulate. When they articulate it, they're taking a step towards the action, and that's why the Secret Service jumps on it. What I think, and you can check my column out this week, and on point, I make this point at the end of the column about people have to watch out under these circumstances in this long struggle that is the war on terror. You do have to pay attention to what individuals say. You have to weigh it wisely. You have to be mature about it. But the other thing is, you can't be afraid to turn and say, you know, what you've said disturbs me individually. I think that you are on the path of taking a violent act. And if a guy says, well, what are you going to turn me in? You're going to be a fink? And you say, yeah, I just might. I'm really going to talk about the way you talk. And to put that into a broader context, that is where you are your brother's keeper. We are the front line of defense in a war that involves the kind of self-starting terrorist activity that I think Hassan represents. He's an al-Qaeda sympathizer that turned into an al-Qaeda actor. You have to pay attention. And I think it's cowardly and wrong-headed not to bring it up to say you've got to pay attention.
Now, Austin, you correct me if I'm wrong, or Jim, you correct me if I'm wrong on this, that when it does come to constitutional rights in the military, they are somewhat abbreviated, right, because of being in the service.
I think the problem, they have the Uniform Code of Military Justice, and it's much more abrupt, as it were, in dealing with things that can be dragged out interminably if you're a civilian and under the regular civil law. But what's really happening here is people not wanting to be in the spotlight. It will be played out in the next months, in a year, whatever, who exactly did what. But there are already documents coming out where supervisors of Hassan were saying, this guy is not competent. There's something wrong with him. A recent one, just came out. I think it was written by his boss up at, I think he was at Walter Reed before he went to Fort Hood, and he said, this guy should not be, an Army psychiatrist. He's incompetent. He's lazy. He's this, he's that. All negative things. And it was passed on. So the person who had to make the hire fire decision didn't want to pull the trigger. And the reason why they don't want to pull the trigger, because it's obvious that if you do something that can be construed as anti-Muslim, and if you are doing it to someone like Hassan, who has been outspoken about, the oppressed Muslims, et cetera, you're just setting yourself up for being in the sights of a lot of bad publicity, which is not good for your career, and of course it's not good for your own stress levels, because you're going to catch all sorts of crap. Some of the Muslim American organizations sue people who they feel have aggrieved them. So not only do you have the usual publicity, carnival to deal with, but you've got out-of-pocket legal expenses. And this basically dissuades people from doing what they should do. Now, this will probably come out, so you heard it here first. But this is the way these things work.
Right.
But, Jim, what about my contention in this week's on point column that Hassan puts a different frame or a different lens on that kind of bureaucratic log rolling? I mean, people need to take it seriously. Do you see that as a potential, at least social, outcome by the American people, no matter what the bureaucrats say?
Well, yeah, the Muslims have been very clever in comprehending how the media warfare works. They have positioned themselves as victims course, they're not the first ones to do this. One of the decrypted Japanese diplomatic messages right as the war ended was a message to all Japanese embassies. This was after the A-bombs dropped. Literally, it said, portray ourselves as victims. We have to deal with this, et cetera, et cetera. I mean, this wasn't translated until years later because the war was over and, you know, let's forget about this for a while. But this came as a bit of a shock because it wasn't declassified until 40 years later. But it says much about, you know, the whole post-World War II diplomatic history of Japan. Not just the diplomatic history, but the social history. The Islamic world has picked up on this. They have this great feeling of having been, you know, defeated for hundreds of years. Of course, a lot of it's self-inflicted. And this accounts for example, the, you know, the dancing in the streets as the towers were collapsing. You know, you've heard it from people, you know, in the Middle East, the expatriates working there. They were rather shocked. They thought all these people were their friends. And here they are, you know, hooping it up because, you know, 3,000 Americans have died. This kind of attitude suits a situation, a person like Hassan, because he knows he can always plead himself as the victim. Indeed, as he goes to trial, that's probably going to be his defense.
Right.
Post-traumatic stress.
Yeah, which is an interesting
pre-traumatic stress.
Yeah,
pre-traumatic. He never served anywhere.
You know.
No. He's already made an issue of this even before he murdered all those people, that people were persecuting him because he was a Muslim.
Right.
He was outspoken about that.
Yes, now, I know that, but I was referring to the defense that he was suffering from post-traumatic stress disorders if he were in combat. He'd never have been deployed.
Well, no, PTSD in the psychiatric community, I'm sure he's aware of this, is recognized as being present in many situations. Raising teenagers, you know, you could qualify for PTSD. You just finished it with two of them. Teenage girls, no less. And, you know, I mean, it was first recognized among the civilian psychiatric community with the survivors of accidents. And it was only later that the military psychiatric community and the civilian psychiatric community came together. This happened in the last two decades and said, hey, we have a similar situation here. Well, it all seems obvious in hindsight. But for years, you know, it was, it was generally ignored. Shell shock was, combat fatigue was one thing, but people being a little flaky after a bad automobile accident or whatever, were considered quite different. Now with, scientific advances, being able to look at the brains of how the brains are firing as people are discussing their therapy or whatever, you see the same kind of patterns in people who have had non-military trauma as well as those who had military trauma. But the problem with Hassan was that he simply wasn't doing his job. He'd talk about it. But my God, the latest documents coming out, he was, for example, ignoring, not answering the phone when he was on call, handling about one-tenth the patient load of the other psychiatrist at Walter Reed. He was a real bad actor.
Yeah, and the thing is that on the workload for those psychiatrists, it's actually huge because the Army has a shortage of psychiatrists right now.
One reason why somebody will say they didn't fire him.
Right.
I'm sure that'll come up. Yeah, we can predict that. Yeah, we're good at predicting things. So there's a slam dunk for us.
Now, one of the things is the...
Now, Dan, let me ask you a question.
Okay.
Have you gotten that feedback from your own sources that's a...
Yeah.
That's a case shortage of what? Mental health care, not just psychiatrists.
Oh, in general, it's a big problem. Well, we've covered this extensively over the last 5 years of Strategy Page. That whole thing about the 200 days of combat being the limit in World War II. A lot of guys have been far more than that, and as we've covered it, we've shown that they've done a lot to, you know, basically stretch that out. Maybe, you know, a lot of guys apparently can go 400 or 500 days of action now before they become disabled, as it were. But you have a lot of people walking around, and it's particularly harmful to the NCO Corps, because the officers get an extra break. They're always going off on courses and training, whatever, but the NCOs don't get that as much. And these are the guys that are being ground down.
Right.
So they need people like Hassan, you know, well, not like Hassan, but, you know, they need military psychiatrists to basically, you know, try and find out how they're going to avoid having your best NCOs, you know, disappearing from the ranks simply because they're burned out from too much, you know, action in combat.
Yeah, and the problem is that they have to actually rotate over there more often. I think you said this.
Than the officers, exactly, yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And then the officers are actually having the psychiatrists themselves are either having to rotate over to Iraq or someplace else overseas, like Kosovo. People forget we have people in Kosovo still.
Yep. Got them
in.
And that can be stressful.
You're dealing with other places. And so these psychiatrists are looking at, well, you know, I can go out in the civilian world, earn twice as much, and I don't have to go overseas. And so that's why they're having such a, you know, a stress in that area. But one of the things I wanted to touch on was one of the things that has been brought up by some of the other illustrious news organizations is, and by CARE and some of the other liberal organizations, is that, you know,
the Muslim blacks.
Right. They go around.
They're the ones who sue people.
Sue people, right.
If we disagree with them.
And but they have made the statement that, you know, the guy just snapped. He was under so much pressure. But however, you know, one of the things that really puzzled me about the whole thing was how many people he was able to take out and like that. And so I went and researched the weapons he was using. He was using the FN-57, which is a specialized pistol that was built for special operations, where they can load, they have 20 round magazines. You can also buy 30 round magazines for them. They are armor piercing, and he was able to get off, he was able to get off 20 shots with that plus reload. And I think he had another pistol. It wasn't confirmed if that was also a 5.7. But this guy knew exactly what he was doing. He knew exactly what weapon to buy to do the maximum amount of damage, or the pistol to buy to do the maximum amount of damage. And
wasn't an impulse, you know, operation.
Right. It wasn't, oh, I'm going to take my 45, which, you know, a lot of officers have, or my 9mm, and go in there and, you know, he went out and got a specialized weapon to do this.
Well, it had to be a personal weapon, because any weapon he might have been assigned, military weapon, would have been under lock and key.
Right.
Those things are only, you know, given to you, you know, when you need them. The other thing, his workload, that has been shot down by apparently this latest document, which shows he was basically shirking. He wasn't working. he was carrying only a fraction of the workload. So if he's going to plead, you know, overwork, it's going to be a hard slog, because that's what his that's what the document that was sent down after him, you know, pointed out. This is why it's going to be very uncomfortable for somebody in, or one or more people in his chain of command. Because they saw these documents from his immediate supervisors, his medical supervisors, saying,
right,
this guy is no good. We should, you know, and in fact, when this was shown to people in the civilian psychiatric world, you know, would you hire this guy? They said, no. This guy's a shirker. He's a goof-off. You know, and apparently he gave bad treatment to a lot of his patients. You know, so who was responsible for not taking action?
It even looks like his research that he did as a fellow there at Bethesda was odd.
Yeah.
I mean, it was not mainline. Most of those guys do their research in some sort of, you know, they'll do it in PTSD, or they'll do it in drug abuse, or they'll do it, you know, in that type of situation. But here he was doing it on something about Muslims, I believe, and their political views while they were in the army.
I've heard from guys, well, from NCOs, you know, complaining about, you know, dealing with the troops, that there is a certain amount of hazing, but as Austin pointed out, that's fairly normal. And he said the consensus among NCOs, you know, something that comes up a lot in NCO clubs, is, you know, you just get these guys aside and say, look, you know, cool it, yada, yada. You know, you don't want to be shagging, you know, ragging guys, you know, because he's Muslim when we're fighting Muslims. It's just not, you know, a good thing to do. But there is a
that's rational, that's not going lost in all of the anger and understandable outrage that you are in. This applies to really any kind of organization, not simply a military, paramilitary organization.
No, granted, but the scenario usually is it isn't the immediate friends of the Muslim soldier who caused the grief. It's some guy, you know, in the platoon or in the company who knows, you know, specialists, you know, whatchamacallit is a Muslim and comes over and rags him.
And it's kind of incidental ugliness. But the thing is, this is why I think, and I'm speaking just in my personal opinion of this, a lot of the stuff that you hear coming out in the media, media outrage doesn't simply apply to the military, but so-called workplace harassment and the like. A lot of stuff goes on and gets said, and people have to get ready for this, guys. People have to act like adults and either blow it off or deal with it themselves. And unfortunately, we have had a tendency to see everything in either a therapeutic lens or a quote-unquote victim lens. Someone comes up and lips off to you because you are you look a certain way or a certain sex or the other, smack them back. And that would be a wonderful way to deal with a lot of this. Unfortunately, the culture of victimology gets linked to the culture of let's sue them. In other words, a legalistic response. So there's
Well, the problem is the media doesn't like that kind of reality. They just like victimhood, you know.
Exactly. That's what I mean.
I can see Hassan's lawyer, you know, playing right on that. I mean, that's basically his best shot. You know, I'm a victim, the devil made me do it, whatever. I mean, the lawyer he's got apparently is pretty good. He's taken some high-profile, you know, military-related cases. He's a retired, you know, officer.
I think he's a retired JAG colonel, the guy's got.
You know, he's got experience, you know, and he's got a track record. So this could be, you know, the kind of high-profile case, you know, officers like him, I mean, lawyers like him love, because it's free advertising. If you can afford me and you're in a bad situation, baby, here I am. I get results. But what's going to happen, something useful is going to happen in that the system that allows this sort of thing to go on is going to be exposed. I mean, commanders who are basically in tough situations. I mean, I make no bones about that. I would not want to be in Hassan's chain of command. He is the subordinate from hell. You know, you can't win. No matter what you do, you know, you're basically, set up, you know, for a potentially very bad situation. And I'm sure, you know, the guy who was in his chain of command who basically pulled the trigger on Hassan's career, you know, may even come out and say, look, you know, what am I going to do? I'm under pressure to hang on to psychiatrists. And at the same time, there's an even more remote possibility of some guy going postal. And, you know, it's a reasonable decision. You know, how many Army psychiatrists have gone postal, you know, in the last 50 years? Probably very few. So, I mean, it was reasonable. You know, I shouldn't really keep this guy. He'll probably admit that. But at the same time, you know, we need shrinks. And maybe one of his professional supervisors. You know, the guy who makes the decision here is usually not a doctor. You know, and the guy, the Medical Administration Corps or whatever.
Medical Service Corps.
These guys are not MDs, but they do command doctors. But at the same time, you know, he's looking at it, it was in black and white, saying this guy is incompetent. So, you know, that's going to shed some very unwelcome light on the way the Army basically supervises its medical professionals. And I think a lot more dirt is going to come out. Because it's no secret that the Army hangs on to a lot of second-rate doctors. You know, if you can't make it anywhere else, you can just join the Army. For example, there was a TV show on about Mad Men, that was it, yeah, the 1960s. And one of the characters in there was married to a doctor who basically washed out of his surgical residency or something like that. And he didn't know what the hell he was going to do. He thought about becoming a psychiatrist. This is oddly, you know, prophetic. He was thinking about becoming a psychiatrist, but he said, that's BS in so many words, apparently. But then he realized, hey, I can get a job. I can join the Army. And they make me a captain.
Right.
And I got, and they'll let me be a surgeon. How weird is that?
I did notice that one of the things that the press fumbled badly on was they were going, wow, he made major really fast, not realizing that.
Yeah, they didn't understand.
They don't understand
the military system on there.
Right, yeah.
I saw that happen.
The other thing that I think is going to show up as a ball fumbled is probably the military's own investigation system and likely the FBI, because apparently the FBI had been investigating some of this. And I think there's going to be some black spots there, too, not just in its chain of command.
Well, basically, it was a hot potato. Nobody wanted to basically be in the same room when this thing blew up. Not him shooting people, but just people having to be accountable for basically what is an incompetent Arab American medical officer.
Like one of the things that Dan, I noticed we're coming up on time too here though is that. And I'm going to be the system advocate on this. We recognize that he's got a fantastic attorney who knows the system in and out, and he's going to play it. Jim has brought up the victim card. We've actually discussed it. But I think the investigation, given the loss, the anger, the understandable frustration that is going to surface, as Jim talked about, commanders dealing with the subordinate from hell, but the frustration with certain kinds of limitations on dealing with this is going to come to the surface. I think we're going to get, from the military, I'm not going to talk about the civilian agency, from the military, a very tough, thorough, and I hope brutally self-critical. I'll add that, I hope, but I know we're going to get a tough and thorough investigation, and I'd like to revisit this topic once that investigation is completed, and we're allowed to see it or hear it.
So. Right, and we have all.
Well, the military. The one positive thing coming out of the tragedy is the fact that situations like this do allow the military to speak bluntly. Because most of the time, they understand there's a chain of command, there's a commander-in-chief, and there's all sorts of appointees, you know, between, you know, in that chain as it wends its way down to a colonel in command of, you know, a bunch of army psychiatrists at Walter Reed, and that they are made to understand. There are certain things they can do and certain things they cannot do. And they also are made to understand that they cannot talk about these rules, the unwritten rules. Well, in this particular, in proceedings like this, they are allowed to talk about it. Of course, they're going to catch hell for it, but that's, you know, goes with the job.
That's the investigation.
Yeah.
All right, guys.
Well, I think that's a good place to leave it. We'll come. It'll probably be at least a year, maybe 2 years before we revisit it. But,
well, you know, I said that, Dan. We will revisit this.
Yeah. Yeah, well, I think there will be also things that come up over the course of the investigation that come to the press's attention that we'll be hearing about, too. All right, we'll talk to you gentlemen next time.